From the studios of WBAA Public Radio in West Lafayette, this is Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. We appreciate you joining us on the show this month. And if ever you've got a question you would like to get on this program, you can email that to news@wbaa.org, and you can tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. I got to ask, did you go anywhere for spring break? Did you do anything fun?
Well, work is fun. No, I was right. I was right here. I am going to take a few days this week, but by long scheduled arrangement. But no, last week, and you know, it's honestly when things do quiet down, it is a time you can catch up and also do a little bit of long range thinking. So I find it useful sometimes to not go away when our students and so many faculty do.
So let me transition that into a separate question, which is one of the things that you did last year that's happening again this year is Purdue is taking a few days at the holidays at the end of the year and basically extending out the time that employees can take off if they're non-essential, if they have the ability, giving people essentially a week at the holidays to say, go spend time with your families. Why did you make that decision? Was it so that you could get caught up on things or other people could get caught up on things?
No, I promise you it wasn't about me. No, my first two Decembers, I made it a point of walking around. It was very quiet, one of those beautiful periods, really. We had snow, I think, at least one of those years. But I wandered in and out of a few buildings, and I couldn't find too many people anyway, and couldn't find too many people who seemed to be doing anything really essential. Had some very nice visits with people around, you know, the platter of Christmas cookies that someone would bring in. So I just suggested to the trustees that I didn't think it would set the university back at all from a productivity standpoint, and I thought that people might well put that time to good use with family and so forth. And I have to say that I do feel that our experience with it has been positive. First of all, don't believe it again that it did any damage at all to performance on the campus, and a lot of very nice comments, a lot of very positive feedback from staff, and that's why I think we ought to continue it.
When I worked down at Indiana University, they seemed very proud of the idea that they didn't close for anything. They were constantly open, and it would take the worst winter blizzard or something that you could possibly imagine to close, and that did actually happen one year I was down there. And I've noticed this is something that seems sort of true of multiple Midwestern universities. We're very proud of how hardy we are. We're very proud of the fact we can stay open through thick and through thin. Do you worry about Purdue being perceived the other way of, Purdue can take time off whenever it wants?
No, I don't. We have the same tradition. When school's in session, we try to go to school. I know we did have to close 2 years ago when we had that brutal cold and snowy stretch that went on, it seemed forever. And we did call classes off for one day, and I'm told that was only the second or third time in history. So we have that same outlook. We did at that time simply because they had declared a transportation emergency. I was really worried about faculty and staff getting hurt or, you know, trying to come to work. So, but I think that's a completely different thing from being family friendly by rearranging the calendar at the holidays. And again, just a flood of nice and positive comments from people who felt that really enhanced their family holiday experience. And so I think it worked out well.
Wanted to touch on something that you and I briefly talked about last month. You didn't have as much information, so I wanted to come back to you, which is we're getting close to the time of year where a lot of employee evaluations are done, and that, of course, gets employees thinking about raises and things like that. You had said last month that, of course, last year a lot of people got as much as 3.5%. You said you didn't think it would perhaps be quite that much this year. What has the intervening month given you time to think about in terms of what people can expect for raises?
Well, a lot of work and thought's gone on, but it's still a little early to make any announcement. A lot of people got more than 3.5 last year because 3.5 was the pool, and we strongly encouraged and incentivized units not to just simply spread it around like peanut butter, but to use it to reward really good performance and to signal substandard performers, hey, let's do better. So I don't know what the biggest raises were, but they would have been well in excess of 3.5. This year, we'll just have to see. 3.5 was the biggest raise in any of our competitors, among any of our peer group last year. And I hope that sent a positive signal about how we value employees and about the financial soundness of the university. But we'll have to play it case by case, and probably by our next conversation, Stan, I'll be able to tell you.
Are you planning to use the same rubric this year of you get a pool of money, but you're allowed to go above whatever the baseline is to reward the top performing employees or to get the people who could be doing a little bit better to get up to the standard?
Yes. What you're talking about was that last year we said the last 0.5% is optional and discretionary. To get it, you have to come with a plan to help the whole university do a little better on the way it uses space, on the way it rewards good employees, and so forth, and being a little and trying to reduce the administrative expense of the place, so we can use those dollars for academic mission. And we like the notion of that. We like the results we got, and I do expect that to be part of this year's budget.
That makes me think about something else that has been talked about a little bit, which is with respect to administrative bloat, as some people call it. I've heard people decry the notion that universities have an assistant vice provost of that or an associate chair of this. Has Purdue been successful in trying to reduce some of those administrative positions and thus bring down the overall payroll cost, frankly, to the school?
Yes, but no. Let me explain. Yes, we have been bringing down the number of administrative positions. We can count these, and there are some very conspicuous, high visible jobs that we simply let expire or decided to do without. Now, the payroll not necessarily going down. The whole idea of reducing administrative excess or finding savings anywhere we can in the budget is to do two things. One is to help keep costs down for our students, which we've had some progress in doing. But the other is to reinvest. We have the highest number of faculty Purdue's ever had right now. We've been growing the number of faculty. And by the way, we have a higher ratio, around 72% of those are tenure and tenure track than our peer group by a long shot. So the whole point of trying to be more careful about administrative spending or spending other than on the core mission of the university, research and teaching and engagement, is to free up resources that can be invested. And I don't think we've done nearly what I hope we can, but we've certainly moved the needle in both cases.
This is Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue President Mitch Daniels. Send your questions to news@wbaa.org or tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter if you've got a question you'd like to be on the program. With respect to cost savings, I wanted to get your thoughts on an editorial that recently appeared in the Lafayette newspaper here. There was a former head of dining services at Purdue who claimed that you were, in his words, not mine, claiming to try to kill Purdue dining by cutting costs and going to lower quality options potentially of food. How do you respond to that, especially since it was put out there in such a public way?
Well, the letter writer was the longtime head of dining. He's passionate about that. He did a great job. I know he's fondly remembered, and we thank him for his service. A couple points are in order. He said in there, for instance, that we now have some of the less expensive dining in the Big Ten. That's true. It wasn't true in 2013. We had the second most expensive food in the Big Ten. It's only more affordable now because we asked them to make consecutive reductions, which they have, of 5% twice. And now we are relatively affordable, but we were not in 2013. And I'll tell you what bothers me about that. One of the first things I learned, having dinners with students, as I do often and was doing a lot in my early days here, we were driving students off campus because of the cost of food. I was very surprised to hear this, but I heard it multiple times.
Now we should say you don't mean by car, you mean forcing them to go to restaurants off campus.
Excuse me. What I mean is, no. They were moving off campus to save primarily to save money on food. This was a people ask you always ask what you know what was your biggest surprise. Well, this is on the list somewhere. I didn't understand that at all, and that's why I got interested in the cost of food. Why? Because we have a concerted effort to encourage and help more students to live on campus. Because students who live on campus do better academically and graduate at higher rates and so forth. It's not a feel-good measure at all. It's very much about student success. So nobody's going to kill food. That's a little bit of that's a very extreme statement and exaggeration. But we've had two consecutive reductions in the cost with no effect that I can discern on the quality of the food. It's still tremendous, and the variety is tremendous. I mean, we found some things that could easily be corrected. They didn't have to make their own dressings, have different salad dressing in each food court. They didn't have to make their own soup individually to have great soup. We didn't need, it turns out, a giant warehouse food locker when we can rent one for a tiny fraction of the cost right across the river in West Lafayette. So there were some common sense things that could be done that don't affect the quality, but did affect the price. And we have gone from one of the most expensive to one of the less expensive. As a consequence, it's a reason we're the only school around that costs less to go to now than it did 3 years ago. And that's going to continue to be our policy. We want really good food, and I know our students appreciate it, but that's no excuse for not looking here as in every other area for to see if there's some way we can get the same result or better at an affordable price.
I have been in numerous situations with you over the last couple of years where I've heard you tell me or somebody else how surprised you were at how good the food was and how plentiful the food was when you got here, and that being one of your bigger culture-type shocks as soon as you got to campus. Now, the writer of this editorial takes a slightly different stance. He has obviously heard you say this as well, and his feeling seems to be that it's code for the food is so good, I see this as a place we can continue to cut costs. Is he wrong about that?
I think I just gave you the answer. We want really good food, but I don't want it at a price that forces students to make a decision they might not otherwise make and leave the leave campus residences. And so with full appreciation for what was obviously a multi-year enhancement of the food here to its really quite remarkable condition today, for with appreciation for his role in it, I'll just tell you that the food's at least as good now as it was 2 or 3 years ago, and it's 10% less expensive. That should tell you something.
Do you think you'll be able to, or will you attempt to, secure further price cuts from your suppliers?
Well, I don't care how they do it. I'm not sure that's been the I'm not sure that cuts from suppliers have been a part of it so far. Some of it, again, has just been doing things at scale that for some reason they were doing in small quantities before. There's a lot of ways probably to improve, and I'm very proud of those who are leading that program now for the improvements they've been delivering.
While we're on the subject of food, I wanted to talk about a speech you gave at a Washington, D.C. area conference last month. You criticized people who speak out against the use of GMOs, genetically modified organisms, specifically in food. You took a very strong stance on it. Why were you so passionate about that particular stance?
I think saving lives of starving people is something a lot of people can get passionate about, and I'm one. It was a very prestigious invitation. This is the biggest conference the U.S. Department of Agriculture holds. I was one bookend speaker, as I understand it, with Howard Buffett, who's spoken here on campus, a worldwide authority, of course, on agriculture. So I took the assignment real seriously. And I decided that maybe the message I could bring that might add a little value or be a little different was to say to that room, you guys are going to have to mix it up a little bit if this argument, this vital argument, is not to be lost. There's a shocking degree misinformation out there. There have been 2 trillion or 3 trillion by somebody's calculation GMO meal served in, without a single problem. There are thousands of scientific peer-reviewed studies, all of which agree that if anything, the GMO foods of today are safer than the ones that we've been in less precise, more clumsy ways producing throughout really agricultural history. And so I said to them that a genteel, polite, scientific argument, that's the starting point, but that's not going to be enough when a lot of really reckless and false things are being said, people are being misled. So I asked people who are scientists in that crowd, there were regulators, and there were people who from the world of agribusiness, and I said, I know it doesn't come naturally, but this is a moral question. We cannot feed 9 billion people without continued advances in technology. By the way, we will damage the environment substantially if we don't use drought-resistant, pest-resistant, herbicide-sparing technologies of the kind that are being developed here at Purdue and elsewhere. And the other side doesn't play by, isn't constrained by any apparently scruples or Marcus of Queensbury rules, and you're going to have to be a little more aggressive too, because lives are at stake. And if you can't be passionate about that subject, what moves you?
So one of the things you said during your speech, and I'm quoting now, is that you said that this is one of, you said the attack on GMO technology is the most blatant anti-science of the age, end quote. Isn't that a bit of hyperbole on your part? Because you've got, likewise, these battles you're talking about, where you've got science on one side and people who are anti-scientific on the other side. You have people who are urging that climate change is not a thing, many of them members of Congress. You've got people who are urging not to have kids vaccinated. That's a public health problem.
Stan, I can't think of a more blatant. There are others, of course. I can't think of a more blatant one because it's 100% of the scientific studies on one side of this. There's not a single one I can find, respected one by anywhere, that says different. Again, trillions of meals successfully served. So I don't think it's exaggerating. I didn't say it's the only example in which bad science is out there, but on these other, on any other question I can think of, there actually are competing scientific viewpoints, and they may outnumber, but it's not so one-sided as it is in the case of GMOs.
I've got to ask you this next question, and permit me, if you will, to get through this. There's a Purdue trustee, Sonny Beck, who's the head of a company called Beck's Hybrids. He's made quite a career out of producing these GMO products, and subsequently, we should say, donated a fair amount of money to Purdue. Likewise, another trustee, someone you appointed, Joanne Broyette, works with a company that helps to warehouse grain, and so she's perhaps connected to this grain economy as well. With that the case, and with you being such a major fundraiser for this university, which is something that the trustees have said that is a big part of your job, something very, very important to them, is it at all a conflict of interest for somebody in your position to make this speech that you made?
Did someone send that question, or is that yours?
That's mine.
Well, then I'll be gentle about it. I think that's but I think it's outrageous. Listen, if I'm fronting for anybody when I raise these issues, by the way, I've said things like this before I came to Purdue, but it's the scientists on this campus. Think of the money we are investing in our plant science initiative and so forth. It's the faculty who are working in these very areas whose work is being falsely criticized and so forth. So I'm concerned as a citizen in this world about the about continued progress in feeding our fellow hungry fellow human beings. And it never enters my mind for one second that we have people associated with Purdue. Although, of course, we do. We're a land-grant school. We've been involved in agriculture from its beginnings. We've been involved in, frankly, genetic modification from the very day this school got here, because agriculture has been in crude ways in the past. So speaking up for science, speaking up for hungry people, it seems to me doesn't need a whole lot more justification.
Let me ask you the other side of the question, which is you've correctly stated that Purdue plays a large role in agriculture and in doing the science that surrounds agriculture. Can universities and should universities be doing more to help people wage the fight that you're asking them to be a little stronger about?
Yeah, I think so. That was part of the message. And again, I understand completely. I've lived in the business world. I've lived in the government world where regulators abide, and now, of course, for years on this campus. And that was the whole point of the talk was, I know it doesn't come naturally to mix it up and to point out the moral dimensions and the humanitarian dimensions of good versus junk science. But in this case, I think they're going to have to. And as I say, a lot of people came up after or wrote in, oh, good, you know, go get them. And I said, no, not me, you. I said in that speech, I said, I'm probably the least technically credible person in this entire room to speak to these subjects. I haven't made a career in biology or agricultural science. So I was really appealing to them in each of these three sectors to get a little bit out of their usual zone because so much is at stake.
We've got just a few more minutes with Purdue President Mitch Daniels today on this Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with him. Send your questions via email to news@wbaa.org or tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter if you'd like them on this program. In other agricultural news, you were part of a team that, by news accounts anyway, helped to convince Dow AgroSciences to keep its large presence in the state. Can you tell me about A, how you got involved with that, and B, what your role was in those talks?
I can just say that I got a call and was asked to join in the conversation. I'm told that the two companies made that request, but that's...
They asked for you.
Yes, and because not me, really. I think it was, although I did know one of the two CEOs from prior life. I think out of respect for and regard for Purdue and the strong relationship that we have had. So I was glad to do it. Took me back a little to my last job where every day it seemed like I was talking to some business somewhere about bringing jobs to Indiana or growing them here. But I stayed, as the current saying is, within my lane and spoke when spoken to and within the confines of the Purdue relationship, basically.
What did they ask of you?
Well, I don't think I should go into details of that conversation, except that along with the two public officials who were there, we were trying to make a strong case both for the business climate here, which is superior, and they knew that. And for the quality of life for the people that work here and might work here in the future. So I was glad to try to help. I don't know if anything I said had a positive effect or not, but seems to me that was a matter of duty, and I was happy to provide it.
But it sounds like they were asking you to wear the hat of your current job and the hat of your previous job a little bit.
Oh, I think so, just judging from the conversation and their questions. But I was... Both are easy stories. I love to promote Purdue, and I still love to promote Indiana.
On to other things. We had known that news that we got recently was coming, and we'd sort of, I think a number of us in the media had sort of kept this under wraps. We knew Morgan Burke was going to retire as Purdue's athletic director. He's the longest tenured current AD in the Big Ten, a position that I think even he has said he never expected he would get to. What are you looking for, and what do you think the trustees are looking for in his replacement? Because Purdue is at an interesting place with respect to, you've got some athletic programs that are good, some historic ones like the football team that need to come back. Morgan, during his tenure, has overseen the building of a lot of facilities, but there are still some like the football stadium that are going to need large scale amounts of money spent on them. So this is an interesting nexus point for a switch from one AD to another. So what are you looking for?
Great and tough question. And I don't pretend to have a complete answer. That's why we assembled a search committee that we think's got some combination of academic, athletic, and business minds on it, because all those go into the modern athletic director. I laughed with some people. I I can certainly remember the time when that job became vacant, just hire the old football coach. It wasn't too hard to do, and glad hand the alums a little bit. And it's so complicated now. You need to be a media expert. You need to be a legal and regulatory expert. Obviously, let me ask you about that.
Because Morgan came from a law background, had worked in the business sector. Uh-huh. Is it likely that you're going to be looking for, but obviously was a swimmer at Purdue, an athlete at this university in the past. Are you looking for someone with a similar pedigree?
Don't know. You know, it's not impossible. When you look to see where today's athletic directors are coming from, there have been a couple of reports on this. Some of them come from that direction, maybe a little more than in the past. We've got a couple of Stephanie White and Rod Woodson and Matt Light, three terrific fairly recent Purdue athletes who've been out around the world of athletics at the professional level too, people who see these questions from other directions. I'll tell you the one thing I can say for sure. We will certainly be looking for somebody who maintains the integrity of the program, which Purdue should never take for granted how high that's been and how rare have been the stumbles or the behavior problems and so forth, who absolutely maintain the academic integrity of the program who will continue, as Morgan has, to operate a financially sound program so we don't have to tax either the students or the taxpayers of Indiana to support our sports program. Now, as I've always said, those are three prerequisites. After that, I really want to win. I'm as big a sports fan as there's ever been in this job, probably along with Fred Hovde. And I live and die by our sports teams. We've obviously want to see some improvement. We have 18 sports. Most of them are in very good shape. Football's in a down period, and we're all eager to see us return to competitiveness there. That's clearly going to be one job for whoever the next person is, to have a good hard look at the marquee sports. But we also need not to lose ground in terms of the standards that apply across all 18.
Real quick, in just our last minute or so, do you think that somebody connected with Purdue has an inside track because they have already a love for the university, which is obviously something that an athletic director it's useful for them to have?
Another great question, and it can be argued either way. In fact, I read a recent article about the pluses and minuses of either coaches or athletic directors being alums. Usually helps at the front end. People feel good, and you know that the loyalty and passion are there. On the other hand, it can lead to expectations that are hard for that person to, as soon as something goes wrong, that sometimes there's a little extra disappointment. So I personally can see some advantages, all else equal. But there's so many things that go into that position now that, that's why we needed a great search committee. And I'm not going to try to prejudge either the criteria or the finalists they come up with.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot as always. We'll do it again next month.
See you then.
I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Support for WBAA comes from your membership and Gaylor Electric, proud to be lead sponsor of the monthly conversation with Mitch Daniels. Gaylor provides electrical services from pre-construction design through project completion and a 24/7 service department. Information at gaylor.com.